Lita, go!
Without looking up, the doctor grabbed the squatting caretaker by the arm. The woman resisted, but with surprising strength, Lija hauled her to her feet, away from the corpse of the man she had tended so lovingly. They shot through the doorway and into the merciless sunlight.
Don't cause problems for her. She had no choice.
There is always a choice. Why did you kill him?
We didn't kill him.
What did he say to you?
Frantically, Anya weighed their options. If the newcomer really was Promason, she doubted that either she or Dan had any prospect of talking their way past her. And although she was wiry, it was the wiriness of strength, not privation, meaning she wasn't of the colony.
Enough. You won't be able to selfishly hoard your secrets away from the world for very much longer.
So, you are just another colonialist, Anacreed, come to steal what we have made by our own sweat and suffering. Come to enslave us again.
How do you know my name?
They're surrounding the hooch, Anya.
Dan raised the same pistol he had carried in the warehouse back in Manaus at the woman, but with startling speed, she crescent-kicked the weapon. She spun rapidly into a back kick that caught the young activist in the stomach and knocked him crashing out into the daylight. Other figures moved outside. Even in a glimpse, Anya could see they lacked the scarecrow gauntness and feral furtiveness that characterized colony inhabitants, even the armed gang members. Anya snapped her attention back to the tall woman as the most immediate threat, despite the chaos outside. Reaching behind her shoulder, the woman produced a machete. Off balance and with no time to concentrate the sword into being, Anya fell over to her right, landing hard on her hip. The Promason rushed at her, raising the machete for a killing downstroke. Just as simply, Anya fired out with both feet, kicking her attacker in both shins. Anya rolled to her right as the woman sprawled across the corpse. Immediately, Anya reversed, rolling back and pile-driving her left elbow into her opponent's kidney.
Oh!
Anya sprang to her feet. From a dark doorway in the wall, Anya spotted something as long, mottled, and thick as her thigh appear. She was confronting a giant anaconda. She knew the breed were contenders for largest snakes in the world, but its sheer size was almost as great a shock as the fact that it appeared from nowhere. The serpent opened its mouth wide. It was pink and edged with an alarming array of back-curving teeth. Anya dove to her right, back toward the dead body and the writhing woman. She came to her feet, but the Promason suddenly rolled and tried to grab her legs.
Get off!
The anaconda coiled by the wall, preparing for another strike. It seemed to recognize the sword as a threat, and with a speed that belied its bulk, it turned to its right and slithered out through a low gap in the wall. Momentarily transfixed by the creature's length, Anya leaped forward to slash belatedly at its tail. Her sixth sense stirring, she spun and raised the sword just as a machete blade descended toward her head with a clumsy forehand stroke. Anya put her shoulder down and slammed it into her attacker's chest. As she was distracted by the melee outside, a second man swung a machete diagonally at her. The man looked European, possibly even American. He was taller than Anya, with rippling spare muscles, a stubble of dark blonde beard, and glaring green eyes. Those eyes widened in surprise. Nobody ever expected a broadsword in this day and age. Anya thrust her right knee up to his chest, then pushed hard with the sole of her shoe against his sternum. The first man, whose machete she had smashed, was headed straight for Anya, combat knife aimed between her shoulder blades. She didn't even turn, but simply thrust her broadsword backwards, running him through the heart.
Shit!
The blonde man was ready for his own second wave attack, but before he could swing his machete, a slash from Anya cut through his descending forearm, then tore through his chest. Anya spun to see more men crowding in through the hut's entrance and the hole smashed by Dan's body. Each clutched a weapon of some form or another. She turned towards the only exit left, the thin wooden walls of the shanty. Not 4 yards away, Anya saw Dan crouched behind a line of big red plastic drums. Two bodies lay in the street across from him. A wide grooved trail with hints of red led to the mouth of an alley across the road, suggesting someone may have been hit and dragged to cover.
Get down, Anya!
Anya tucked and rolled, coming up next to Dan, trying not to be aware of the hideous stinking muck that smeared her from knees to hair. Glancing up, she saw a pattern of small holes in the planking. She knew instantly it was buckshot.
The Promessans are using shotguns?
I don't think so.
A thought the camp guards didn't come here.
I don't think it's them either. This looks more like gangs converging to defend their turf.
Anya was looking back toward the hole she'd made in the wall. She was surprised the Promasons hadn't come boiling right out after her. Perhaps they were tending to their fallen comrades inside. Just as likely, they were none too eager to blunder after somebody who'd single-handedly put three of them down. Two, probably for good.
We have to go, Dan.
I was going to say we should stay and fight, but if those lasers are back, that's enough to get me moving.
Dan jumped up and ran for the far side of the street. Anya kept her head facing back towards her adversaries, but followed close behind. The shotgunner, a feral-looking man in a filthy headband whose refugee gauntness clearly marked him as a denizen of the colony, leaned out to take a shot at them as they broke cover.
Well, I guess those lasers will work in our favor some of the time, at least.
Anya and Dan burst through the open, uneven doorway of the hovel across from the one in which the wounded Promason exile had died. Anya's heart dropped as she eyed the big cat that stood 10 feet away. It was heavy-bodied, although no more than 2 yards long, from nose to tip of thick, twitching tail. Its fur seemed almost to glow with a light of its own through rosettes like sunspots. Its eyes were huge and green. It was clearly what the natives called a golden onza, a beast the educated city folks at least affected to believe was mythical. What it was doing in the midst of this man-made hell made Anya's brain ring with cognitive dissonance. Yet it was no more strange than the 20-foot anaconda. Dan raised his pistol to the roof of the shack.
What the hell was that?
Don't even ask. We need to keep moving. We're right up against the jungle here.
If you say so.
I do. Now go. We need to get back to the Citadel before this whole colony lands on our heads.
A passageway lay open right before them. As her eyes grew accustomed to the gloom again after the dazzle of outdoors, Anya could make out that it led back to what seemed a jog or juncture for dozens of yards. They ran down it. A figure appeared in front of them, with wild eyes planted deep in a skull-like face. In the dark, Anya could just make out the shape of a sawed-off shotgun. Apparently, the man hadn't been so perceptive when it came to Dan's pistol.
This is getting out of hand.
They ran on through the cramped, gloomy, reeking space.
What was that?
Somebody threw a Molotov. We need to get out of here before we fry.
Continuing on at a quickened pace, Dan and Anya passed a dogleg right-hand turn. As they came around it, they faced another claustrophobic corridor with doors or rough hangings to either side. Despite bad light and headlong flight, Anya had the impression that rather than one big purpose-built building, they ran through a warren of shacks that had simply sprung up together, following some obscure logic of the builders, or maybe none at all. The ceiling changed level from flat to pitched to slanting at a crazy angle as they rounded random jogs and junctions and stumbled over thresholds of varying heights. The passage twisted and turned without perceptible plan. Smoke had begun infiltrating the weird, winding passageway, hanging at head level. Suddenly, three figures materialized in front of Anya. From their hard, fit appearance and athletic posture, she could tell at once they were Promasons, not starveling colonists. One held 2 2-foot sticks of polished black wood. The two in front carried machetes. The passageway was only wide enough for two people to pass abreast, no higher than a couple of feet above Anya's head. It wasn't the most cramped stretch they had run through, but left little room to swing a weapon. Fortunately, the same limitation applied to Anya's attackers. With the hilt of her sword in both hands, she hacked through the machete of the man on her left. The one on her right recoiled in surprise, bumping into the stick-wielding man behind. Anya slammed her hilt against the side of the first man's head and gave him a vicious sidekick, sending him tumbling towards the decayed hanging that made up one wall of the passage. The second machete-wielding man struck for her head. Anya swung her left foot up and around in a roundhouse kick to her opponent's right short ribs, exposed by his low attack on his left. He managed to get his right elbow down, fouling the blow and absorbing most of the fierce hip-turning kick. To block the kick, he had to hunch forward, bringing his machete with him. Anya tipped her sword back over her right shoulder and cut down, as always putting her hip into it and driving with the legs. She spun into the third man, She brought the heel of her foot crunching down in an axe kick that mostly, by good fortune, hit him square on the left wing of his collarbone.
There's more of them coming on you! Look out! Ah! Oh, shit!
Anya rolled back to see Dan just as the gang member who shot him strolled from a doorway on the right, as nonchalantly as if he were going for a walk in the park. Anya jumped to her feet, even though she knew it was futile. Dan was almost 20 feet away, and there was no way she could get to his attacker in time. Smiling, the man raised the stock of his rifle to his shoulder, sighting down the barrel at Dan, who had slumped out into the corridor, doubled over his knees, a knot of helpless misery. Suddenly, Dan twisted sideways, bringing his gun up in both hands, thrusting out to extend his arms fully in an isosceles triangle.
No!
Dan rotated to a sitting position.
Dan!
Fell for it, asshole.
As Anya reached for her wounded companion, Dan rose to a knee and started to stand. He turned a grin of triumph toward Anya. Dan retrieved a full reload from an inner pocket of his vest, clipped between a couple of fingers. Anya had been meaning to ask why he encumbered himself with extra clothing in the unremitting wet heat. Now she knew.
Nifty piece of cutlery you got there. Where'd you get that thing anyway?
Tell you later.
I'll be sure to ask.
Let's get out of here before this whole place comes down on top of us.
Anya, look out!
She wheeled, not right, but left, counterclockwise. It allowed her to lead with the tip of the sword, gripped two-handed and held horizontally to her left. A young man had emerged from a door only a few yards away from her, bare-chested, with a red cloth band holding hair back from a handsome Indian face. The sword punched right through his sternum and into his heart. Fixed on hers, his dark eyes widened. They stared a final question into Anya's eyes. Then the light faded from them. She was suddenly seized with a sick horror.
He was unarmed.
Suck it up. He was one of them. See? He doesn't look anorexic.
He wasn't armed. I killed him.
He was an enemy. He ran up on you.
What have I done, Dan?
Choose now, Anya. Move or die.
All Anya could do was nod. He turned and raced out ahead, weapon grasped in both hands. He didn't even flinch from the flames that lashed at him and filled the corridor with a hellish orange glare. Anya followed Dan into the inferno as he vanished to the right around an unseen corner. She felt the heat sear her upper arm, and the pain was like a penance. It snapped her back to the situation. Batting at smoldering hair, she turned the corner and found herself facing another long corridor. Blessed daylight shone at its far end, a dazzling white oblong a good 20 yards away. She saw no sign of Dan, but a figure blocked her path. It was short and unmistakably feminine. In spite of the flood of light that blurred the figure to shadow, Anya recognized her antagonist immediately.
Shia. Anya Creed, you don't know what you do.
I'm fighting to break free the secrets you're selfishly withholding from the human race. If you want to call that neocolonialism, go right ahead. But your people's murderous ways have shown you aren't fit stewards of whatever power you hold.
I see you've been talking to Isis. She can be a bit strident. I hope you didn't damage her too badly. She has a good heart and great promise.
What you know about a good heart, I haven't a clue. But if Isis is the tall black woman with the green headband, she was alive when I left her.
If you keep on this path, I must fight you.
Silhouetted by sunlight and front-lit by the flickering flames around them, Anya could see that Shia was fuller figured than she'd looked in her exquisitely tailored suits in Belém and Manaus. She wore a dark green wrap around heavy breasts and a loose brown skirt like a sarong around full hips. Her belly was a dome of muscle like a belly dancer's. Anya held her arm out to the side, started to form her hand into a fist to pull the sword from its special place. Then she let her hand drop to her side. Treacherous as Shia and her people were, Anya felt she had sullied the sword, sullied her soul. She would not give in to damnation by deliberately striking down an unarmed person, no matter how deserving. Anya charged.
She expected the woman to try to sweep her legs, tackle her, or kick at her belly or pelvis. The low line was the strongest attack against a taller foe. Instead, Shea leaped straight into the air. Her rump-length hair formed a dark nimbus around her head. Unable to stop, Anya ran right into her. Shea wrapped her legs around Anya's belly as her arms tried to tangle the taller woman's. The hair enveloped their heads like a cloud. Air exploded from Anya's lungs, driven by Shea's hard-muscled butt pounding into her solar plexus. For a moment, they were nose to nose, completely enclosed by Shea's amazing midnight hair. Her hands were like steel clamps pinning Anya's wrists to the floor. The ground was slimy and irregular beneath her. She felt ancient ooze seeping through her clothes at shoulder and butt.
It is not too late for you, Anya. You have been misled.
By you! Anya planted her feet and violently arched her back. The smaller woman was bucked off her hips like she were on an angry rodeo bronco. With Shea sprawled out on the ground, the way to the outside lay clear. Anya doubted she could make it without her opponent taking her down from behind, and her nature rebelled against fleeing, though she knew it was the right thing to do. She rolled over and jumped to her feet, just as Shea did the same. The beautiful woman cleared a curtain of heavy black hair from her face with a flip of her head, then grinned at Anya.
Not bad.
Anya advanced. Shea blocked and redirected Anya's blows with apparent ease and a remarkable economy of motion. Even as Anya struck for her in dizzying combinations, she marveled at the other's skill. Strength began to ebb from Anya like blood from an opened vein. Shea, her oval face serene, looked as if she could keep this up for a week. Anya decided to try power where technique had failed. She shifted weight to her back foot to fire a sidekick. Shea flowed toward her and slammed a palm heel into her sternum. Shea's dark figure rose above Anya's prone body. Even with Shea towering above her, Anya's eyes were drawn away, back down the hall. A gang member stood in a crouch, firing a Kalashnikov from the hip. The brilliant yellow muzzle flare illuminated a face seized with a look of pure ecstasy. Anya looked back up, wondering why Shea hadn't heel stomped on her sternum. The air was empty of all but roiling smoke and drifting motes of dust and spores. The hallway between Anya and the door to the outside world was a roaring hell of flame. The Promason woman had vanished. It was time for Anya to do likewise. A hint of light showed beneath a blanket hung in a doorway to her right. She rolled through it into a tiny room just in time. A tiny off-square window let sunlight filter vaguely into the room through yellowed newspaper taped across its crossed slats in lieu of glass. Anya coiled herself and jumped through it. She put a shoulder down as she landed and rolled clear of the wreckage. She got herself to her feet by sheer willpower and desperation and took off down the narrow alley. Speed was her only slim chance at life. Anya tried to force her mind clear so she could better process her surroundings and circumstances. She was alone in a tiny space that initially seemed to have no outlet. Then, ahead of her, she noticed the outward-leaning wall of the shack to her right didn't quite meet that of the hovel beyond. She also noticed all the buildings around her were in flame to a greater or lesser extent. If she lingered another minute, she'd best pray the Kalashnikov gangbanger blasted her from the blown-out window. Only that would save her from burning to death. Anya raced around the almost hidden corner. Running through coils of brown and dirty white smoke, she saw ahead of her, 30 yards away beyond a cross alley, two men fighting. It was Dan, and looming over him was Patricinio. Dan, barehanded, launched a savage 1-2 combination, left hook and right cross. The punches came at their target from the sides, outflanking most attempts to block them. Patricinio leaned back away from his opponent, slipping the blows. His bare brown upper torso gleamed in the sun as if oiled. His dreadlocks, held back from his handsome face with a golden band, flew like a Medusa tail of serpents about wide shoulders. Dan's right hand went behind him, coming up with a handgun. Patricinio flicked the 9mm pistol with the back of his left hand. The muzzle flame must have seared Patricinio's left bicep. Unburned propellant and primer fragments must have peppered his bronze skin. Paying no mind,
He stepped into Dan, dropping his weight and driving a compact vertical punch straight into Dan's chest above his heart. Dan did not go flying back the way Anya had from Shia's palm heel strike between her breasts. Instead, his body seemed almost to balloon away from the blow, up and outward. He staggered but stayed on his feet.
No!
Patricinho looked straight down the burning alleyway and into Anya's eyes. His beautiful, long face seemed full of infinite sadness. The black handgun dropped from Dan's fingers. Anya plunged forward, across 15 feet of open death ground. Just inside the cover of the far alley mouth, Anya was finally forced to stop by the scorching heat, safe from any pursuing assailants, but unable to proceed to the aid of her friend. The flame curtains parted, and as though through an opened gate, Dan walked unsteadily toward her. There was no sign of Patricinho. Anya ran to him. His face was horribly pale, his lean cheeks ashen beneath his fine two-day beard. He scarcely seemed to breathe.
My heart. It's my heart.
He staggered, then fell to his knees on the foul ground of the alleyway. One hand spasmodically clutched the front of her shirt. His pale eyes were wide. Then he smiled. It was the sweetest smile Anya had ever seen. She instantly knew that it would haunt her dreams so long as she lived.
I see it all so clearly now.
Dan? Dan?
Sir Ian Moran didn't feel the need to ask permission to enter the conference room. Beneath a chandelier like a wedding cake of light and crystal, deep in the bowels of a little-known chateau perched high in the Bernese Alps, there stretched a long, massive table of oak, dark-stained and polished. Around it sat a dozen men. They were old men. Sir Ian was junior in the room by a good two decades or more. Their hair was silver or white or absent, their clothes exquisite, with the unobtrusive perfection rendered by masters of the tailor's art. These men brought unobtrusiveness to an art. Their names were unknown to the public, or only incidentally so. They sat on no thrones, in no cabinets, held no chairs in any corporate boardroom. No ties connected them to any government or corporation or recognized institution, visibly. They were as far above such things as eagles over ants. But every single person who served a government or multinational, no matter how low or high his rank, served one or another of them indirectly. Publico surveyed them with contempt. They saw themselves as self-anointed masters of the world, but they were actually just withered old vultures. The ancient at the table's far end raised a head of hair like spun glass. On a face liver-spotted and sagging with the weight of years, he adjusted his glasses. Like the presence he projected, even seated, even tethered by plastic tubes from his nostrils to an oxygen tank discreetly hidden behind his chair, the piercing blue eyes made no concession to age.
Sir Ian Moran! What is the meaning of this intrusion?
I meant to correct a most unfortunate oversight on your part, gentlemen. You seem to believe you could make me wait upon your pleasure like a lackey.
And what do you think to gain by storming in here like this, young man?
My rightful place.
Ha! That has to be earned, my friend.
Ah, but have I not earned my place and then some? I served you well, gentlemen. I've done your bidding and more.
Do you imagine that we hand out memberships to the most exclusive council in the world, like crackers at a child's birthday party? You have served well, it's true, Sir Ian, but you have likewise been well recompensed.
You think to hire me like a tradesman, then?
The men stared at him, showing no discomfiture. Security in the chateau was absolute. At the least aggressive movement, he would instantly die. Even the volcanic force of his own presence, his reproach, made no impression on them. They were men long inured to shame, and likewise to injustice. Publico leaned forward confidently.
If he could make no overt threat, he could still emphasize his very potent presence.
Some of you have lived even longer than your visible decrepitude would indicate. Your relative anonymity, thanks to your control of the world's media, ensures that no one notices anything unusual about you. I know there are others, members emeritus, who yet have a voice in affairs. Those of you who sit here today do so because you either have physiological resistance to the current generation of treatment, or because you fear to step away from the table of power for long enough to undergo the full extent of rejuvenation. I know that at your level there is no friendship, no loyalty, no brotherhood, only fear and interest. And your fellowship is that of a pack of wolves, always looking to rend the weak.
You think to force us to admit you to our ranks by insulting us?
I might if I thought you were any more capable of being insulted than feeling shame.
Pray you are correct in that, Sir Ian. We might not make the truest of friends, but as enemies we are dauntless.
If you will not make a place for me at your table, gentlemen, I shall be compelled to force one open.
Others have tried that before, Sir Ian.
But never I. Do you deny that you have discovered the means not just of life extension, but life renewal?
Why should we bother to deny or affirm, for that matter? We have no need to answer to you, Sir Ian.
Do you really think not?
You think your billions impress us?
Ah, but I do. Don't forget, I'm a man of deeds. I've made my mark upon the world. I've taken actions. Indeed, some even on behalf of this august if nameless council. And I've a following. When I speak, tens of millions listen. Hundreds of millions. From the scruffiest streets activists to crowned heads and corporate gods.
Ha! Do you honestly think that we don't control as much and more? They may dance to your tune, Sir Ian, these masses and ministers and monarchs. Even march to them. But will they kill and die to them as they do ours?
Do you honestly want to find out?
Enough, Sir Ian! You err grievously if you believe mere wealth or vulgar repute can gain you entrance into our councils. You are permitted to leave now, Sir Ian. I will stress this word. Permitted.
Sir Ian Moran stalked down the hallway, emanating rage. He knew that he had been their last chance, and this thought came with as much relief and satisfaction as it did anger. The water of the Amazon was ochre. Anya Creed stood in the riverboat's blunt bow, one walking shoe up on the gunwale, the other on deck. She gazed up the course of the river. The far bank, the left, was visible only as a green thread along the yellow flow. On the right, the forest loomed over them so close that the outer limbs almost overhung the tubby rundown vessel. The monkeys in the trees were not the only primates in Anya's sight. The boat was packed with mercenaries from the small platoon that Sir Ian Moran had arranged to accompany Anya as she searched for the Nine Bold Tree. From there, the long-held trove of secrets kept by the descendants of escaped slaves would not be far. Whether they had been brought to Feliz Lusitania especially for the task, or recruited from the gang-like internal security forces, Anya neither knew nor cared. They were heavily armed and showed every sign of ruthlessness. That was all that mattered to her now. She was bound on a mission of justice. She needed hard tools. These men were that, at the very least. She would not have chosen many of them herself. The better part of them spent their days perched precariously on the rail, taunting monkeys on the shore. The ship was about 60 feet long and 20 wide. It had a modest deckhouse extended forward by a corrugated tin canopy and by a tent-like awning astern. There were also cabins below, stinking, close, and crowded. Anya had chosen to pass the first night alone on deck, under the tin shelter of the elevated wheelhouse, for protection from the rain that drummed down half the night. The cabins offered a modicum of privacy. The captain, a short Belgian with a silver fringe beard, had offered his own, probably by prearrangement rather than gallantry. But even the captain's Spartan deckhouse quarters reminded her too much of the hopeless hovels she had been cursed to witness at the colony. A tall blonde kid from South Carolina crouched atop the deckhouse, wearing only shorts and bulky combat boots. The skin stretched over his washboard ribs was fish belly white. It was already changing to boiled lobster red on his back from the sun. If Anya's extensive field experience was any guide, he'd be writhing in agony by the early equatorial nightfall. But like the rest, he loudly claimed vast combat experience. He cradled a long black M16 rifle across his knees. He had already promised to kill a monkey before they arrived at their destination. Some of the other men had begun casting less than professional glances her way the moment they shoved off from the Feliz Lusitania dock upstream the day before. The looks kept getting hotter-eyed and longer. She expected trouble by tonight. She was ready for it, and anything else for that matter. She was ready now for things she never would have even considered before. Anya had been forced to leave Dan's body behind. There was no way to carry it while she threaded her way through the maze of hazards back to the central compound. Gomez had assured her his bosses would recover the body. Dr. Ligia de Carvalho had paid her a visit in her chambers as she packed for the trip's final leg. Each expressed pleasure the other had made it out alive. The doctor asked if Anya might please help her young daughter. Although she obviously felt constrained in what she said, supporting Anya's suspicion the rooms were bugged, Anya got the strong impression the little girl was being held hostage for her mother's compliance. Anya felt genuine sympathy. Yet she had to tell the doctor there was nothing she could do for the child until she had finished what she was doing now. Ligia, though obviously disappointed, thanked her for her kindness and left. Anya wished she could help, but Dan's death had sealed her, it seemed, to his viewpoint. She felt Ligia's pain, but Ligia and her daughter were only individuals. How could the welfare of a single individual, or even two, be weighed against the common good? The Promesans had committed grievous crimes, crimes against all humankind, as well as Anya and Dan. By withholding their knowledge, they caused enormous suffering. Now, Anya would wrest the secrets forcibly from the Promesans' grasp, or die trying. And in return, she would give them retribution. Throughout the day, the mercs along the rail grew increasingly impatient with the pale-skinned would-be hunter. After finally giving up at taunting uninterested animals through the tree line, they had turned to him.
All right, y'all. You wanna see? Y'all look here.
Billy shouldered his rifle. Still no targets presented themselves, and he held his fire. As if to assert his own dominance, he brandished his rifle above his head, miming triumph. Anya stopped straining her eyes at walls of green, always seeking the tree with nine trunks, to watch the proceedings. She felt a mild stirring of professional anthropological interest. Billy shook the rifle and grinned at his comrades below him. Anya raised a brow. That teeth-bearing display was certain to be interpreted by the monkeys as a threat, and Anya wondered how they would react.
Hold your horses! I will get one! You just wait!
Billy's grin was frozen on his sun-reddened face as he glanced down at his chest. The butt of an arrow stood a hand's breadth from his sternum. The fletching was black as crow's wings.
Hostile! Open fire! Open fire! Cease fire! Cease fire!
Anya looked around. There were no bodies visible through the tree line, no blood, not even more arrows. Peering back, she could see Billy's body bobbing lifelessly in the water.
Lieutenant, should we turn around and pick him up?
They're not worth going back into the kill zone.
Whatever happened to never leaving a man behind?
He lost. Let the gators have him.
Even in the middle of the night, the wet Amazon heat was unbearable. Anya had tried to sleep starting at dusk. Still, the crush of fatigue had only driven her to that point long after sunset. She had exacted promises from Captain Lambert and Lieutenant McKelvey that they would detail men to keep watch throughout the night for the nine-trunked tree. She had formed a sheet of mosquito netting into a sort of pup tent above her, but it restricted what little airflow was generated from the boat's slow, steady passage upriver. And when sleep came, the images she saw were anything but soothing.
it.
We're gonna have us some fun, honey. I'll scream and I'll cut you.
For a moment, Anya stared into the man's narrow and hard face, then, spotting his black K-bar knife, immediately went limp.
That's right, honey. Just take it easy. You'll like it. You'll like it so good you'll think you never got it before.
With his free hand, the Merc started fumbling with the buttons on Anya's shirt.
Once you do the Ranger, you will never be a stranger.
Anya shot her left hand out, seizing his knife wrist, then shoving it and the big blade to the side.
Wow, so you want to make it interesting, huh?
The man sat astride her belly, but he was too far up to control her long, powerful legs. She flexed her foot, then swung it up at his head.
Ah!
The man reared in reaction, waving the knife wildly. He had come up onto his knees, taking most of his weight off her. She whipped her legs again, wrapping her feet around his neck. She locked ankle over ankle, tucking her arms like a boxer's, clenching her fists, clenching her whole body to aid her effort. She rolled to the right with all her strength and weight. Anya jumped up, with nostrils flared and eyes wide and furious. She had an audience. At least a dozen men were gathered around, standing or squatting, to watch the show.
Anybody else want to play?
If they rushed her, she was ready to summon the sword. But in a way, she already had. The mystic steel had entered her spine, her soul. The fires of its forging blazed through her eyes. No one made a move. Anya would sleep solidly the rest of the night, untroubled by dreams.
Up ahead! The tree!
Anya awoke, blinking the sleep from her eyes. Her head was still fuzzy as she crawled out from beneath the mosquito netting, but that quickly subsided as she rose to stand upright in the bow. Ahead, just where the great river bent to the right, its base obscured by mist as if it floated on a cloud, a vast tree, or collection of trees, with 9 trunks wound somehow together, leaned out over the mighty Amazon. Their beachhead was a natural clearing filled with shoulder-high grass. Anya had previously spotted what she believed to be a driftwood raft caught on the bank, another 100 yards or so past the 9-trunked tree. But as they got closer, she could see that it was actually the remnant of a wooden dock slumped into the water. As the boat approached shore, the men gripped their weapons and stared fixedly at the landing site. Anya thought it was professionalism belatedly asserting itself. A distressed-looking Lieutenant McKelvey disabused her of the notion as he removed his crumpled boonie hat to wipe sweat from his forehead.
This is a bad place. We better pray your man Moran gets plenty of reinforcements into us pretty quick, like he said he would.
Why is that?
Logging party got ambushed 10, 20 clicks back upstream from here, about 3 months ago. They had a whole security company with them, 120 men or more, with armored cars, machine guns, mortars, everything. Another 200 or 300 workers, bulldozers, I mean the whole 9 yards. Indians just wiped the jungle with them. Total massacre.
Why didn't I hear about it?
It wasn't the kind of thing that goes on Fox News, ma'am. Not everything that happens even gets on the internet, especially when it happens way out here in the back of beyond. A few survivors made it back to the gold camp. Some of Bull Campbell's boys got to talk to them. It sounded like a real horror show.
What happened to the survivors?
The lieutenant shrugged, but Anya noted his eyes slid away from hers. The Amazon camps were an ultimately Darwinian environment, and the big cage in the river always needed new gold panners, she reckoned. Ashore, the men moved with self-confidence, seemingly restored by familiar tasks. They unreeled rolls of the same German razor tape that topped the fence around Feliz Lusitania. They set up curved plastic tablets whose convex face was stamped with the legend "Front Toward Enemy." They erected little stands of equipment. It was all a very solemn ritual. Anya had already knocked about the world enough in her young life to be familiar with most of it. The knife wire was suitably nasty, so were the Claymore mines, and the infrared detectors and infantry radars were undoubtedly far keener at night than plain low-tech human eyes. The night before setting out from Feliz Lusitania, Anya had spoken briefly, almost robotically, by the camp radio phone to Publico. He said he had finished his urgent mission overseas. He would join the party when they found the 9-trunked tree. She had not asked him what his connection was to the camp and its evils. It no longer seemed important. Her quest consumed her utterly. According to plan, the mercenaries, once having secured an initial perimeter, would move beyond their current position to construct a landing strip. As the activity got well underway, McKelvey came to Anya, standing near the water, seeming pleased.
We got it under control now. We're doing what we do. We shouldn't have any trouble.
That's what we thought all along, and you've lost 3 men.
Well, they're Indian attacks all the time.
In the backcountry, on mining and logging camps, tourists and trade boats come up and down this river all the time. They don't get attacked by Indians. Why your men now, with all these other incidents? And how many cases of anacondas attacking people have you heard about?
Well, now there are those movies.
There are documented accounts. A few. But 2 fatal attacks since getting on the boat? You think that's coincidence? Someone... something doesn't want us here, Lieutenant.
Well, rationally...
Yeah, that's what I want to believe, too. But how rational is that level of coincidence?
Well, that's what all the guys with guns are for, aren't they?
Sure, Lieutenant. And they'll probably even be some help.
Yeah, lucky there's a clearing here, huh, Miss Creed? Helps a lot.
I'm not so sure it's luck. I suspect this is an old abandoned rubber plantation. The jungle takes longer to reclaim some fields than others.
You really know a lot about this place, don't you, ma'am?
Not as much as I intend to, Lieutenant.
As the men set to work hacking and trampling the high grass, Anya decided to have a look around for herself. Walking off through a stand of trees along what she suspected was an old road leading northwest, she waved off the worried lieutenant. Emerging from the trees, she saw a cluster of buildings standing at the edge of the clearing a couple of 100 yards away. Guessing one was the old plantation house, and feeling the archaeologist's urge to explore abandoned human habitation, she struck out for them. She kept an eye out for any of the numerous types of poisonous snakes that could be lurking to bite her. She kept her eyes moving all around, in fact. There were other dangers that never realistically threatened ecotourists, such as native arrows, anacondas, and, of course, golden onzas, not to mention the odd green energy beam. As she walked along a rutted track through more high grass, she wondered what other defenses the Promesans might have in store. Whether or not this was the actual border of the settlement known as the Quilombo dos Sonhos, they were near to it. She was sure of it. As she drew closer, she could see that the structures had fallen into ruin. The main building's brick walls, which had surely been expensively hauled all the way up the Amazon by shallow-draft steamboats, still mostly stood. Smaller outbuildings, presumably of wood, had mostly slumped into overgrown mounds. Seeing that the entrance to the large plantation house was barred, she surveyed the thick vines that descended from roof to ground. She tested the strength of one. Inside, she found the upper floor and ceiling had fallen in. She could see the sky above, blue with clouds beginning to close. It would likely rain soon. The floor was a jumble of broken beams and furniture, much covered by vines and grass, and even brush growing through the floorboards. Looking up at a jut of beam from the wall right above the entrance, she saw rippled char on its end, seeming to indicate that the house had been burned through. Whether the fire had been started by accident, lightning, or arson, she could only guess. The Promesans did have a brisk way of dealing with things that outlived their utility. People as well as artifacts. If the fates of the anonymous man in Feliz Lusitania and Mafalda in Belém were any indication. Finding nothing, Anya crossed the plantation to the other sizable building. It was a chapel. Its walls of gray granite and even its arching slate roof were largely intact. The forest had grown right up against it. Inside was bare but for broken pews and a layer of jungle litter on the flagstones. Buttresses mounted up the walls. Green lianas climbed them, as did chittering monkeys. Little blue ground doves pecked around the hollow altar. The windows had been broken out.
Anya Creed! You won't need that.
She has black hair, bound by what looked like a thin jade band around her temples, fell around her shoulders. She wore a sleeveless top of shimmering green, and what might have been a green suede skirt, leaving her firmly muscled stomach bare. The straps of sandals twined up her bare legs like serpents. At her side stood Patricinho. his arms crossed over his muscular bare chest. He wore loose brown trousers with gold trim and low boots with no visible seams or fastenings. Figured gold amulets encircled his forearms. His dreadlocked golden brown hair was swept back into a brush at the back of his head by a gold cloth band. He was so beautiful she wanted to believe in him. Neither carried weapons that she could see.
I think I do need this.
Do I even have to point out that if we wanted you dead, you'd be dead already? Or that we can escape at will?
If I'm alive, I presume it's in your selfish interest to keep me alive.
She almost gets it, doesn't she? I told you. There is hope for her.
We shall all know very soon.
You think I'm gullible because of how easily you tricked me before? I may be a naive and spoiled North American. I may not be as streetwise as I like to think I am, but I am capable of learning.
Good, because time is short, so learn fast.
I already know all I need to about you.
Do you really believe so?
You know nothing, Anya. You have been misled, lied to at every turn.
By you?
No.
Even now, if you look deep into your heart, you can see the truth. Please do it.
You are betrayed. Now you risk betraying yourself and all that you stand for.
How dare you talk of me betraying what I stand for? What do you know about my destiny?
In blind, weeping rage, Anya cocked the weapon back over her shoulder to strike and rushed at the two Promasons before her. Shia and Patricinu stepped backward out of the doorway and to the side. Passing through the doorway, she looked in every possible direction. They were gone. There was no point in pursuing, she knew. This was their forest. They could ambush her or evade her at will, but at least she knew she was in the right place. After clearing whatever plant life covered the designated landing strip, the mercenaries had vetted the field for relative flatness and firmness. They were pleased to learn that it was nothing the little aircraft, and a seasoned Brazilian bush pilot, used to landing on rough fields, couldn't handle. Mladko and Goran emerged wearing loose, long-sleeved shirts and tan trousers. Their shaved heads were covered in Panama hats. They winged out to each side of the aircraft door and stood with thick arms crossed. A similarly attired Publico emerged. McKelvey, alerted to the plane's approach by radio, snapped to attention.
Sir!
Lieutenant McKelvey? Ah, Anya, my dear. Just the person I want to see. You can carry on, Lieutenant. You're doing a splendid job.
Yes, sir, Ian. Men, let's unload the plane.
Come, Anya. Walk with me. Talk with me.
Sure.
You've done well by me.
They walked back towards the plantation house. Anya held an internal debate as to whether she should tell him what had just happened in the ruined chapel.
I've a proposition for you, Anya. You're a remarkable young woman. You've achieved great things, and you're really very beautiful, you know. So here's my offer. Become my consort, and we'll rule the world together.
I thought you meant to give the whole world the gift of immortality.
Are you daft? To hold such power only to give it away? I'd have to be a fool.
You can't be serious, Sirian.
I'm deadly serious. You've put the power of the ages into these hands.
Why me? What you said about me is very nice, but I don't have any illusions I'm anything special. Especially in the looks department. You've got to see that. You have beautiful women throwing themselves at you all the time.
Don't sell yourself short, Anya. Your appearance is quite striking. And intelligence as incisive as yours is an aphrodisiac. That and tenacious will and competence, such as you've displayed, they'd set you apart from a sea of pretty faces.
Anya and Publico stood at the border of field and brush. A stand of trees stood between them and a derelict field that adjoined the old plantation house. He ran the back of his right hand down her left cheek. She thrilled to the contact. There was a magnetism to the man, she had to admit. And yet, what he was saying went beyond bizarre. If he meant it, it was monstrous. But she couldn't believe, wouldn't believe. Surely they hadn't gone through so much. Surely Dan didn't die for some kind of B-movie megalomaniac. She reached up, took his big, hard hand, pulled it gently but definitely away from her face.
What are we really talking about here, Sirian?
With the secrets we're about to wrest from these selfish holdouts come power. Infinite power. With it, quite frankly, I shall force the world to put me in charge.
You really think...
Who better to lead the Earth into a new era than an immortal philosopher king, an undying humanitarian? I shall use the carrot of eternal life and the stick of denying it to make myself undisputed ruler of all humanity. And then... Well, the human race wants paring back. The Earth demands no less. It will be all for the best. You'll see.
You mean you'll promise the masses immortality and not deliver?
Of course I won't. It would be like giving an infant an automatic weapon. The height of irresponsibility.
So all this happened. All these people died. Dan died in my arms just for your ambition?
If you care to reduce it to such sordid terms.
You lied to me.
You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs.
I'll stop you.
Please, dear child. You're a girl alone in the wilderness. I have a squad of armed men at my back. Don't let my glowing assessment of your capabilities go to that pretty head.
I have capabilities you've never dreamed of.
So have I, my dear.
Oh! Anya slammed into a tree, the kinetic force of the blow rippling through her entire body from back to front. She shook out her head and looked up. Impossibly, Publico stood 20 feet away. Sir Ian reached down, grabbing her beneath the chin and lifting. She grabbed his forearm to try to ease the pressure on her windpipe. It was like grabbing a steel tube.
I may not have the secret of rejuvenation yet, but as I think I've hinted, love, I do have access to certain technologies you've been told were decades in the future, if even possible at all. Among these are the means to give a human extraordinary strength and speed and endurance, albeit temporarily. How very fortunate that, unsure what I might be flying into out here on the very fringe of the enemy's domain, I thought to dose myself right before landing.
Evidently, Publico's wonder drugs didn't armor his crotch.
Attack!
The sword, she knew, was more powerful than all of treacherous Sir Ian's wonder drugs. But not even it could shield her from a couple of dozen mercenaries with automatic weapons. They were boiling out of their riverbank cantonment now, weapons ready. Goran and Mladko were running toward her from the aircraft with guns in their hands. She turned and ran. Passing through a stand of woods, she came out again into the long, fallow field. The soil beneath her soles was black. The black Indian earth, so rich and mysterious, in a realm where no natural topsoil existed. Ahead of her rose the jungle, shore of a green sea that stretched unbroken as far as the eye could see. If she got into the dense brush of the transition zone, she could lose herself. Clumsy Western mercs and Croat war criminals could never match her in the bush. She'd eluded such before. Momentum carried Anya on into the brush. She fell down a short slope, rolling. Her limbs obeyed her near-panicked mind reluctantly, and she managed to rise to her feet. Lightning agony flared through Anya's right side. She tried to rise, but was unable to lift herself from the brush. Blackness washed over her like a wave, and the world receded into night. I'm not dead.
Not yet.
Anya shot into an upright position. Patricinio and Shia sat beside her bed, which was positioned in a sort of alcove to one side of the room. The floor and bedspread were deep maroon. The walls were a pale tan that showed a pearlescent undertone in the sunlight streaming in the pointed arched window. Rainforest plants sprang up in profusion about the room. It was comfortable, warm rather than hot. For the first time in what felt like forever, she was aware of not being oppressed by humidity a percentage point or two less than the bottom of a swimming pool. Yet the window apparently stood open, letting in waves of fresh air. Both Patricinio and Shia wore long, loose robes. His was maroon in the center and black down the sides. Hers was shades of blue in diagonal swirls. Her hair was twisted into a complicated knot atop her head, and she wore large turquoise earrings. His dreads hung loose about his shoulders. Anya let herself relax back into the bed.
Are you going to say, I told you so?
No.
We only tried to tell you so.
How?
How is it you're still alive? We healed you, of course.
Oh, my.
Relax.
But they shot me. I'm sure I felt bullets hit.
Not to put too fine an edge on it, but you were mortally wounded.
How long have I been here?
3 days.
3 days? I must be dosed to the eyeballs on painkillers.
No need. Patricinho told you. We healed you. You might feel some residual pains. We can block those. If they keep recurring, we can teach you meditation techniques to make the pain go away. But you should feel no lasting effects.
But that's...
impossible.
How did you ever get me out alive? I know the mercenaries chased me into the undergrowth. Did I just pass out and fall into some bush where they overlooked me?
We ambushed them about the time you dropped.
The old plantation is what you might call a buffer zone. It gives us room to maneuver on familiar ground against intruders without letting them in among our crops and homes.
Okay. You know, it's really hard trying to prioritize the questions. They're all crowding toward the turnstiles at once, and it seems important none of them gets trampled.
Take your time. We have a little breathing room.
All right. Why?
Why what?
Well, I was going to ask why you saved me, and that's probably what surprises me the most. But it's all suddenly starting to land on me. Why did you bring me here?
In part for the reason you just demonstrated, Anya. Your remarkable agility of mind.
When you don't let your habitual skepticism bind you.
Well, perhaps I'm jumping to conclusions. I guess it does kind of verge on paranoia.
The way is starting to bind you now.
Why did we bring you here? I take it you don't just mean why we spirited you away from the place where you fell wounded.
No, I meant what you thought. Why did you permit me to find you? Or lead me here, whatever.
Why do you suspect we led you to us?
Is he always like this, Shia?
Except when he is worse. That is why he's smiling all the time. It makes it harder to throttle him for being such a pain.
Anya looked back at Patricinho. She thought anyone would face quite a challenge trying to throttle him. She forced from her mind an image of his crushing Dan's heart with a blow of one of those fists. So relaxed now, it seemed they'd be hard-pressed to do anything more militant than pet a kitten. She had a great deal of mental processing to do, but she didn't have much time to spare.
We kept conveniently finding just one more scrap of evidence that led us up the river. I began to suspect in Manaus that Moran knew more than he let on.
He did. Our poor friend Herr Lindmuller was able to remember enough to provide him with a general idea of where the city lies. Enough so that Moran felt compelled to kill him to keep him from telling anyone else. Our mental techniques are not infallible. He should never have had those dreams.
You brainwashed him?
Although it chilled Anya to hear the claim Moran had murdered his friend, Lindmuller, she realized that the germ of suspicion had entered her mind in the River of Dreams offices, where the representative mentioned he had fallen to his death, supposedly rock climbing, despite his fear of heights.
We conditioned him, as he agreed to before he was ever brought here. That was our bargain. He could come here, make deals, highly profitable to both sides, and even receive various restorative treatments. But in return, he had to give up any memories of our existence.
So what did Publico need me for?
So Ian obviously guessed we had means of preventing detection from above. So he needed your skills to pin down our location. He had no way of knowing where along the way you might pick up the vital clues. But he did act subtly to keep you moving in the right direction.
Also, it appears he was auditioning you, so to speak. Testing your suitability for his larger plans.
So you were eavesdropping on us at the airfield?
Of course we did. This is our land. We do what we must to defend it.
I have so many questions, but my mind keeps coming back to one. Why did you bring me here?
Because we may have much to teach each other.
It is your sword. We sensed that it had been restored.
You sensed it?
It's an artifact of tremendous power. When such an event happens, when something so powerful is made whole again after such a long time, The world rings like a bell for those who know how to listen.
Is that what you want? To get the sword away from me? I suppose if you did want to take it from me, I might just say go ahead. But you don't want that, do you?
Not at all.
But what... what about Publico? Is he gone?
Him? No. He smells the prey now. The sickness of power is upon him. He'll never give up. Short of success or death.
He's got the reinforcements. Specifically, he's mobilizing some members of the Brazilian Army and Air Force against us, under the pretext that our Quilombo is a terrorist stronghold.
Isn't that a pretty thin pretext for Publico to use?
If you are strong enough, Anya, come with us to the other room. We will show you what some of your North American news programs are saying.
Rogue Angel is continued on the next CD.